Throughout the 1980s, a strange phenomenon was sweeping North America.
They were in a panic. And like people in a panic, they want solutions.
Allegations of underground satanic cults, torturing and terrorizing children. The thing is, there were no satanic cults preying on children. And nearly 30 years later, the people touched by it all are still picking up the pieces.
This isn't a work of fiction. This is a work of history.
Satanic Panic, available now.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Rosemary Barton.
And I'm Elamine Abdul-Mahmoud.
And this is Party Lines.
The big news out of Ottawa this week involves the government's list of terrorist entities. They added several groups to this list, including the Proud Boys, who have, of course, been linked to storming the U.S. Capitol last month. What does this new designation actually mean, Rosie? I want to talk about whether it will change anything.
The other news this week, and possibly every week, is about vaccines. Canada's capacity to manufacture vaccines here at home. And at a moment when supply is raising some concerns, especially amongst the opposition parties anyway, will new funding for domestic manufacturing actually make a difference?
Lots to get into.
Let's do it.
Okay, we are recording this not long after the government announced that it is listing a bunch of new groups as terrorist entities. And it is a really big story. The Proud Boys are on that list. They are the big name on the list. The government calls them a neo-fascist organization. They, of course, were in the news pretty recently because they were really present on that January 6th insurrection in the U.S. Capitol. They've also popped up a lot of times during Black Lives Matter protests. They've targeted Black Lives Matter supporters with violence. Also on that list, the AWD, who are neo-Nazis. Also the BASE, which is another neo-Nazi group. The government has pointed out that the BASE has actually distributed manuals for lone wolf attacks. So that's pretty significant. And Rosie, this is a story we've been anticipating for a while. It's particularly escalated in the last few weeks since those riots at the U.S. Capitol. There has been a lot of political pressure after that event. And we heard NDP leader Jagmeet Singh repeatedly call for the government to do something about far-right extremist groups, put them on the terrorist list. The government said, we're not going to do this as a political decision, but we will study it and think about it. And now it has happened. So here's Minister of Public Safety, Bill Blair.
Today's additions to the list of terrorist entities is the result of a neutral and expert process, which is based on evidence, intelligence, and the law. It is not a political process. It's a legal process. Our national security and law enforcement agencies have been monitoring the activities of these groups for a number of years. And it's important to note that assessing potential new terrorist groups is an ongoing process based on evidence, intelligence, and the law.
Now, some immediate consequences of all of this is, for example, any material support for these groups is now illegal. It also activates a bunch of law enforcement agencies in a different way. So, for example, we heard Bill Blair in that same press conference say that the Proud Boys, he considers the Proud Boys to be an imminent threat. So a lot going on. Let's wrap our minds around it. How significant is all of this?
It's a big deal. It's a big deal because it is not an easy thing to list a group as a terrorist organization. You have to fulfill certain sort of criteria in your investigation. You have to be able to determine it's an organized movement and that there is a real threat of terrorist activity. And it's a really big deal for Canada to now have six far-right groups on this list, and notably Proud Boys, which we've now become the first country to list them. That is the group that, to me anyway, is most familiar on this list, and I think probably to most of our listeners too. And it's partly familiar because it was founded by a Canadian, although he's no longer part of the organization, and has played a role in a variety of events, as you said, the most recent one being the attacks on Capitol Hill. Again, as you said, what it does is it really shuts down any kind of financial transaction that could happen to this group in any organized way. Like, you can't even buy a logo of the Proud Boys without mm-hmm. being viewed as doing something that is then will now be illegal. You can wear the logo, yes. but buying the logo now becomes an illegal activity. And it is part of sort of trying to cut off the funds to a terrorist group that might be trying to plot something. So the minister, Bill Blair, was, said that, yes, events that happened on Capitol Hill on January 6th contributed to this, but that our intelligence agencies and the RCMP and public safety had been working towards getting the Proud Boys on this list. But certainly the events on Capitol Hill sort of pushed them to get to where we are.
In the aftermath of the U.S. presidential election, we've seen an escalation in supports that signal an escalation towards violence for a number of different groups, including the Proud Boys. We've also seen acts in furtherance of that rhetoric and that those supports for towards violence, in that people have actually gone out and engaged, acquired weapons and engaged in activities which are now subject to criminal investigation and charges forthcoming in the United States, which also, I think, strongly supports the growing concern around the activities of this group.
And when Bill Blair was asked, could they be an imminent threat, he said yes.
Right. So I'm interested in this imminent threat and terror designation sort of relationship, because I've heard advocates for years and years be kind of skeptical of the idea of the terror designation. And I will get into that. But let me just say, some of the skepticism I've seen early has been about the sort of tamping down the expectations of what exactly this will do. Like, okay, the Proud Boys are on this terror list, so the government can freeze their asset. Well, I don't think the Proud Boys have a bank account at the local credit union. You know what I mean? I don't think they're pooling their money together to go on field trips. That just doesn't seem like the way that they operate. They're semi-autonomous chapters. So I begin to think, what is the use of this? Because it certainly would have been useful, say, 3 years ago, because it would have given Facebook, for example, cover to boot the Proud Boys off their website. Well, guess what? They've already done that. They've already, lots of social media websites have already purged the Proud Boys and lots of other far-right groups from their platforms. We should also mention who was not on the terror list, because a bunch of names I'm interested in that I would have imagined would be on the list because they share a lot of similarities with the Proud Boys. Soldiers of Odin is a good example of that. We've seen a lot of activity mm-hmm. from them over the last few years. The Oath Keepers, same kind of deal.
3%ers.
Yes, exactly. And so when thinking about what this will functionally do, I guess I'm stuck on what is it going to change now?
Yeah, I mean, is it symbolic or is it practical? Is it a message to the world about how serious we take, extremist movements and white supremacist movements? I think it's possibly all of those things. Again, when we were asking questions about what this changes, it. Apparently, for investigators, again, this is just me learning on the fly with the rest of you, it mm-hmm. does allow them to use more resources. So Proud Boys might be operating in Canada, or any of these groups might be operating in Canada. They might be sort of, monitored or looked at. But a lot of that work would have been done by local police. And yeah, okay, intelligence agencies would sort of keep an eye on it. But putting them on this list now sort of takes it up a notch is the mm-hmm. way I understood it. It means that the RCMP will look harder. They'll build some capacity into it so that they are sort of focused on that group in a different way, and that they can then charge them under terrorist-related charges, which mm-hmm. we should point out are is a very high burden to meet in this country, actually. It's very hard to get someone charged under terrorist charges. It could also do other things. It could, if someone arrived at the border, a Proud Boy from the United States arrived at the border, wanted to come into Canada, they could be denied entry if we were able to determine they were a member. So it does things like that, according to what mm-hmm. we've been told. But does it change anything in terms of the way they function or how big a threat they are? I would have to assume yes, because they will have increased monitoring on mm-hmm. on any sort of rhetoric and talk. But as you point out, if they've been deplatformed, taken off of places where they were doing that, I don't know how much more this means. Do you know what I mean? I'm not sure.
Of course.
Yeah, practically what it changes. It is significant, but it is not clear to me what it changes for the way they operate in the immediate.
Well, I should say that the reason I've heard advocates be skeptical of designating any group whatsoever as terrorists is the terror designation has this long history, at least to September 11th, so a 20-year history, of being used to mostly police people of color. You know, police people of color limit their movement, add greater surveillance to their lives. And yes, there is some, not a lot, but there is some of sort of new resources that are unlocked in terms of dealing with these groups. But are these law enforcement agencies going to start randomly knocking on doors? I've seen a lot of experts who are saying, no, that's not likely. You know, will they add this additional level of surveillance to them? Yeah, but if they thought that someone was a threat, they already have plenty of laws and tools to use to follow them. Like, they didn't need this designation to do that. And I know that there is great political appetite for this designation. And not just this, by the way, but, like, I see it with a lot of other threats, like incel threats, Nazi threats, white supremacist threats. I hear it from progressives all the time, for example, that these people should be labeled a terrorist group. But what you're actually saying is, like, I want the mighty resources of the surveillance state engaged and directed towards these people the same way they've been directed at other people of color. And, like, to me, like, that is not as woke as those progressives think it is, because for a lot of advocates, like, the reason that's not logical is because the problem is the overreach of the terror designation itself and, like, how useful it is. But I will say that, like, all of that aside, it is obviously good PR. Terrorist is a heavy word. It has the appearance of the government, like, throwing the book at these groups. It says we are taking this seriously. And I think a reasonable question is, well, if you're taking it seriously, A, did you just start taking it seriously? And B, like, where is the proof of that seriousness?
I almost wanted you to end there, but then I just had one thing I wanted to put to you.
Yes.
Is it not good, though, to see a government take white supremacist groups, extremist white supremacist groups, as seriously as other terrorist groups that are on here, including like Al-Qaeda affiliates? And I hear what you're saying about people of color and how they would have been treated differently under this. But is this not in any way, do you see this anyway, I guess, as sort of trying to balance things out, for lack of a better word? You know what I mean? Like, just try and make sure that we see white supremacy as something that is very dangerous or equally dangerous?
In that, I actually agree. I think it signals seriousness. It sort of elevates the threat to saying this is on the same level as this other threat that we've been talking about for a long time. But I think the elevation of the threat has to also come with an elevation of, like, taking the resources seriously. And, like, plenty of Muslim advocacy groups can tell you about the ways that surveillance has been stretched into their lives. And, like, I wonder if that's going to happen in the same way to these white supremacists. That sort of remains to be seen.
Hey, my name's Jamie Poisson, and I'm the host of Front Burner. It's the CBC's daily news podcast. And every day, we're discussing the big events and fault lines shaping Canada and the world. Politics, economics, social movements, you name it. Sometimes we even talk about really fun stuff, like the enduring relevance of Lord of the Rings. You can hear Front Burner on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
As we record this on Wednesday, we are back to getting some vaccine in this country. We had a week where we didn't get any, and it was sort of, where the hell are the vaccines every day? All part of the news cycle every day. And as we record this, we know that more are arriving, more of Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine. But it does seem like we are spending a lot of energy and time asking why it's taking so long. And where the vaccines are and why the government has not done enough to get us all vaccinated. So we thought maybe let's just talk about a couple of the things that are happening right now that are going to probably change the situation overnight, potentially. Yes. So let me give you a couple of them. We are back to receiving doses from Pfizer, as I said, after they redid their factory in Brussels. Moderna has slowed down due to some manufacturing, but we're still going to get some doses from Moderna. AstraZeneca is going to be approved by Health Canada at any moment. Mm-hmm. And just this week, the Prime Minister announced that eventually we will be able to make some of this stuff ourselves because they reached a deal with Novavax, which is also on the verge of being approved for use in this country. And by the end of the year, which I know sounds like a long ways away, it will be able to produce, as many as 2 million doses a month in that plant. I don't want to throw a million gazillion numbers at everybody, but why do you think we are so, is it normal to be so, hung up and focused on this issue every day about where we're at, compared to the world and how we're doing?
Well, I mean, I don't know what you want to focus on because there's nothing else to focus on. I mean, like we could talk about the Golden Globes nominations, I guess, but I think
about that actually. I'm very upset with some of it. Yeah,
let's do it. Let's do it. That's on the other podcast. Yeah. There is something to the fact that all this chaos and all this uncertainty about all these vaccine stories. There's that also that additional dimension of will the EU allow the vaccines that we're ordering to get out of Europe or not?
Yeah.
And it is like between now and possibly the end of March. Like, this is the only story, perhaps because we live in Canada in a place where it's a brutal winter and there's nothing else to think about right now. There's like a regular flow of vaccines in arms, every little story that throws off the government's official story becomes a big deal. So like when we get this notification that Moderna is going to delay our supply or Pfizer is going to delay our supply, there's nothing else to do but to fixate on it, even though there is functionally nothing we can do about it. There's nothing we can do because we are simply at the mercy of those companies. And if they, I made this joke on your show on Sunday, but I would say the reigning political strategy of jumping up down someone's yin yang with a firecracker is not going to do it because we just have to wait for the shipments to come. But all we can do is despair. And it is rife for political danger, especially for the government, for any government, I should say, a federal government or any provincial government, when these vaccines are not moving, because all there is to do is to pay attention to all the vaccine stories.
Yeah. And the ongoing pressure on the government from opposition parties, from the Canadian public, questions from the media. I mean, it makes sense. You're right. This is sort of it may be our salvation in the months ahead. It is what will get us back out of our homes at least a little bit more than we currently are. And so it is, I guess, normal that we would be, as you say, right. That's the exact right word, fixated on this. But it is also right to say that the government is actually doing some things. Let me play this clip from the Prime Minister on Tuesday when he talked about sort of why they were trying to stand up this ability to manufacture this in the country.
We knew that standing up domestic capacity was just the smart thing to do, not just for the short term, but to build the kind of resilience and jobs and opportunity that Canada needed through this pandemic. Similarly on vaccines, even though we have strong assurances from the European Union that the measures, the transparency measures they're bringing in will not affect Canada's supply, it is only responsible and right for Canada to be investing as well in our domestic biomanufacturing capacity. And that's exactly what we're doing.
So you may listen to that and then say to yourself, well, why didn't you do that last spring? Why are we just doing that now? Well, they did invest in, creating a plant to do this. They had, they thought, a potential candidate to be manufactured in that plant. It was one from China. That whole thing fell apart. That whole deal fell apart. And at that point, the government went around and started sort of madly signing deals with as many companies as possible to make sure that we were going to get enough. What it had a harder time doing was finding a company that would accept to actually, make the vaccine in Canada. And even this vaccine that's going to be made is not the mRNA vaccine. That is the new technology that Pfizer and Moderna use. It's a different one. And it's very, very hard to obviously, create a plant that's able to do that with that technology. So this is sort of their best or next best solution. as they struggle with all these things that they can't control. And I don't know how that's playing out for Canadians. Like, I don't know if people are lying awake at night worrying about it.
Well, I think the frame of the things that can and can't control is actually a really important one, because every once in a while I have to like sit myself down and remember that since the pandemic started, it has been 11 months. And there is like it's merely been 11 months.
It's been a long 11 months, though.
It sure has. It sure has been a long 11 months. Yeah. But with that in mind, it like behooves all of us to remember that when Pfizer and Moderna said they were going to get this vaccine out, first of all, it was anticipated to be in the middle of 2021. These vaccines arrived much earlier than anticipated. The idea of Pfizer saying we're actually going to take a few weeks off delivering to you to retool our factory to build more capacity is like, it's among the surprises in this process. That's actually a pretty good surprise. It's not a bad surprise that is happening. But it just like, I just have to constantly remind myself that everyone is reinventing everything they know about supply chain, especially vaccine supply chain, on the back of a napkin in like a matter of weeks. And like usually government machinery moves a lot slower. And what you just said, you know, the notion that, hey, why didn't you negotiate this on mm-hmm. day one? Mm-hmm. That's something that NDP leader Jagmeet Singh also said. He was critical of the government waiting for this long. Well, it really has not been that long altogether. It just hasn't. And there's plenty to criticize the government about, but the notion that they are flying by the seat of their pants is like, yeah, of course they are. Everyone is. And that is not a surprise at this point.
Yeah, I mean, a couple things. At the beginning, you'll remember, like, do you remember at the beginning where you could not find a mask? Like, you had to go on Etsy to order, like, a special mask. Or hand sanitizer was, like, a prized possession. And very quickly, many industry manufacturing lines in this country switched over. Now you can buy a mask for like a buck anywhere. I've got hundreds of masks at home, right?
I match them to outfits every day.
Yeah,
it's
me
great.
Too. It's not an issue. But it is much easier to switch a manufacturing line to masks or hand sanitizer than it is to switch over to a complicated, never done before kind of a vaccine. So that's my first caveat, I would say. But the second part of this is really about what the government should be telling us. The Prime Minister continues to say everybody who wants to be vaccinated will have a dose by the end of September. You know, and he stands by that every single time, no matter what bump in the road comes along. So I'm going to hold him to that, for sure, and we'll see what happens by the end of September. But I do wonder if they were more transparent about the deals that they signed with these companies, the assurances they've been given, what leads them to be so confident in that timeline, whether that wouldn't be more reassuring to Canadians than him just, you know, giving us that blanket statement. I realize there's all sorts of, you know, legal issues, competitive issues around showing contracts to Canadians. But I do think transparency here would maybe clear up a lot of this anxiety for people.
Well, especially because that line has been like he's been repeating it with such relish and insistence since we've sort of found out that there's a vaccine and it's to be approved, like since the start of this rollout process. So every single time that we hit a bump in the road, you know, people would look to the Prime Minister and say, OK, you would be understandable if this changed your timeline. Does it change the timeline? And he says no. And I think it is reasonable to be anxious every time you hear that, because maybe he knows something that we don't. But it is certainly going to take an acceleration of the arrival of vaccines, an acceleration of the timeline in terms of how many people are going to get vaccinated in order to make that deadline. But having said that, the Prime Minister continues to hold on to it, and I think it's fair to hold him to it.
That's your weekly reminder of what your life sounded like 11 months ago. Do you know, sometimes at home I put wine in two glasses and I just chin them.
That's brilliant. I'm glad you're having a party of your own.
It's also the sound of Last Call. Eventually, that will be a delightful sound again. I choose to believe
it. One day.
Yeah.
One day.
Last week, we asked you, who do you want to see as the next governor general?
And so I casually mentioned last week that I'd be a fan of Katie Lang taking the gig. And she responded on Twitter.
Shut up.
But She did. But she's not taking the job. She said, I'm too controversial for that job.
So does that mean she listens to the podcast?
I mean, I hope so. I hope someone out there is feeding party lines directly to Katie Lang. That's what I hope is happening. I also appreciate that someone was also thinking among the same musical lines as me and said Jan Arden. And someone suggested Brett the Hitman Hart.
I love Brett the Hitman Hart. Okay, here are a few more names that were mentioned. Olympian, Clara Hughes.
Yes.
We had a listener in Saskatchewan give a bunch of more political names. Now former Senator Murray Sinclair. That one's come up actually a lot. Former Liberal Cabinet Minister Ralph Goodale. Former Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall. Former Prime Minister Kim Campbell. I will say, people, generally the Governor General has to be bilingual. So some of these names aren't going to work. But anyway.
Yeah, remember that.
Yeah.
We also had someone write in, I'm not in a position to judge who specifically should fill the GG role. However, I think Canada needs more Indigenous representation. A prominent Indigenous leader, I think, needs to fill this vacancy.
Now, everyone's in a position to judge. That's what we have established with this story.
This is what we get to do. You just throw out a name. Just do it.
All right. This week, we want to know, are you concerned about Canada's supply of COVID-19 vaccines? Is it something you're worrying about? Let us know. I'm at Rosie Barton on Twitter.
And I'm at Elamine88. Please throw in the hashtag. The hashtag is PartyLines and let us know what you think.
And that is it for PartyLines this week from CBC News and CBC Podcasts. I'm Rosemary Barton, Chief Political Correspondent for CBC News.
And I'm Elamine Abdul Mahmoud, Culture Writer for BuzzFeed News.
And Katie Lang is your fan.
Yeah, we're best friends now.
Apparently.
It's the law. She tweeted me.
See you back here next week.
You bet.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.